This is tape number 4, side number 2 of the missing dimension in 6.
However, if the divine purpose of love expression is to be fulfilled, husbands and wives must possess this knowledge. God did not provide them with instinct. The deliberate repression of this knowledge under the diabolical sex is evil dogma wreaked havoc on marital happiness for centuries. It reduced women, potential heirs of God, to the level of dumb animals. Of course, by the damnable heresy of evolution, Satan has invaded even the supposed intellectual and educated classes in his deception of leading humans to think they are nothing but animals. Satan does not want humans to know their true destiny as begotten and finally born children of God. But God designed sex in humans to express love in marriage. Now understand this. The very fact that the response in wives is generally somewhat slower, the very fact that wives are aroused by stimuli different from their husbands, by the love embrace, by the love caress, by the ardent love talk of their husbands, each telling his wife she is the most lovely, the most dear, the most darling woman on earth, telling her she is the sweetest, the most honored, the most admired, the most precious of women. All this sincere ardor and earnest lovemaking, with the kissing and fondling of the one so dear and precious to him, all this produces sex arousal in wives. At a time like this, a husband realizes in his mind, as at no other time, just how delightfully lovely and precious his wife really is to him. How different is this marital love from premarital promiscuity or a cheap and degrading relation with a prostitute? In either latter case, it is mere self-gratification, not the giving of love to the one not only loved, but respected, admired, and honored above all others, the one for whom he has the very greatest outgoing concern. Did you ever notice that the intense love talk in Solomon's Song of Songs expresses this outgoing admiration, not lust? It was written before his polygamous relapse. To the unmarried, I say, this is such a precious thing, it is a million times over worth waiting for. Any premarital sex, any perversion, mars this potential marital happiness, puts irremovable scars on the marriage before it happens. That may sound extremely out of date in the decade of the 80s, but it's truth. Lovemaking necessary. But under the stern sex is evil code, prior to the mid-20th century, none knew the delights of marital love unless discovered by accident, and then under penalty of a guilty conscience. Deliberately, the all-wise, benevolent God created in women the very type of sex stimuli that requires love. And for man to violate this law or bypass this love need is to impose the penalty of physical pain and emotional anger or resentment. If a husband, immediately aroused, attempts to force the rigid male member into a quiescent and unprepared vagina, real disaster may result. As explained above, the vagina is shrunken, almost closed, and dry. Such a brutal penetration would tear the unlubricated dry membrane along with it, causing pain and producing a mental sense of revulsion in the wife. And yet, even in the decade of the 80s, reports come to me of a considerable violation of this law, even by Christian professing husbands. Some may quote 1 Corinthians 7:4, "The wife has not power of her own body, but the husband." They forget the rest of that verse, "Also the husband has not power of his own body, but the wife. He has no right to use his body to abuse her." But God has provided a wonderful means of bringing about the happy coital love union between husband and wife. This requires preliminary lovemaking. The husband's quick arousal provides incentive for initiating the love embrace, but also it imposes on the husband the responsibility for the mental control of restraint against a too hasty procedure. It was meant for the husband to take the time to express his love for the wife God gave him, that she too may be aroused and properly prepared to share in the supreme and ultimate climax in love-giving. This love play preceding actual coitus produces feminine arousal. This love-giving thus produces the drastic change in the wife's generative organs, making them ready for the coital union. And all this love-making, this caressing, embracing, kissing, This necking and petting, as it is called in current slang vernacular, is actually a definite and most important part of the act of sexual intercourse. I must add, in this revised edition, however, that the change in mental attitude of women towards sex since 1950 has produced marked change in female sexual response. Some women in their 20s or 30s today will say they believe female sex arousal occurs just as rapidly as the male. This may vary with the individual. What teenagers should know. Of all the books on sex available today, one especially that I have used as a text in my Principles of Living classes in our college is, strangely, 50 years out of date in some biological respects. Nevertheless, for a general approach, I have found it the most satisfactory. The 50-year-old biological errors are easily corrected and brought up to date. This text describes coitus as one whole, but composed of four parts or acts of the one drama, four successive phases, one blending into the next. And the first phase of sexual intercourse, this text explains, is the love-making stage. In other words, the very thing adolescents today indulge in freely on dates, necking and or petting. These two modern terms, of course, have various meanings among various young groups, but I use them here as thus defined. By necking, I refer to love-making primarily confined to the neck, face, and shoulders. Only it is seldom love. It is usually sensuous self-gratification, and on the girl's part, it may be the same, or it may be merely what she's willing to give in order to receive as payment, future dates, and favors. This latter puts it on the cheap and shameful basis of the prostitute, who merely exchanges what she gives for money instead of dates and favors. By petting, I refer to petting which descends below the shoulders to places where unmarried hands do not belong, and the term heavy petting is sometimes used for a sort of heterosexual type of masturbation, or as many authors stated, petting to a climax. Today, necking by teenagers has society's acceptance, and even petting is not much frowned on, and premarital coitus has become prevalent, if not the rule. But acceptance by society does not define righteousness or sin. Man has no power to determine what is sin. God has determined what is sin. He allows man to decide only whether to sin, and if he does, even with society's approval, he must reap the penalty of sin, eternal punishment of death. It imposes curses here and now, and robs the sinner of the true happiness and joys a loving Creator made possible. But many a young person may exclaim, necking a sin? Oh, come on now, doesn't everybody neck? How can that be a sin if we know where to stop? The answer is twofold. One, God ordained this lovemaking to be the necessary first and most important part of sexual intercourse. It therefore deliberately breaks the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery, when indulged in outside of marriage. That commandment includes premarital fornication or any other misuse or perversion of sex. It is a capital sin. It imposes automatically, without court trial, the capital punishment of the death sentence. And two, the dating couple all too often don't stop. As to why this is a sin, the answer will come later. It is a sin for the same reason that adultery is a sin. It is not merely because the great God said so. He only said it because it is so seriously harmful to us humans. God denies us no pleasure, no happiness or joy that is good for us and for others. God deliberately so designed male and female sex stimuli and timing so that humans might enjoy the love relationship in marriage. It was definitely and intentionally done to prove the bond which securely binds a marriage and happiness for life. It was purposely so designed in order to constantly increase a husband's love for his wife and a wife's love for her husband. That very private, very intimate, very personal, and very precious love relationship, never shared with any but one's mate to whom God bound one, does increasingly endear each to the other. It makes them truly one. It preserves the home and the family for the welfare and the needs of the children. It protects the most basic and necessary unit of a right society. But such God-endowed marriages are fast becoming a rarity. Promiscuity before and during marriage is rapidly destroying the marriage and family structure. and a solid family structure is the very basis of a healthy society or nation. The women's rights movement and prevalency of working wives also contributes heavily to breakdown of the family institution and threatens the destruction of the nation. The very first woman to introduce and champion the ERA movement was the original mother, Eve. God created Adam to be the man and head of the family, but Eve decided to wear the pants, customary for all women today, took over the initiative, and led her docile husband into Satan's way in rebellion against the Creator God. Modern woman has reverted back to the ways of Mother Eve. Is that modern, or the utmost extreme of reverting to antiquated ways? And all these are God-plane relationships. Why, then, is unfaithfulness to this godly relationship a capital sin? Because it violates and destroys a sacred capital blessing. Adultery, fornication, masturbation, homosexuality are so colossally sinful because they violate, pollute, profane, and destroy something so holy and so monumentally righteous in God's sight. What cheating does. People today don't like to use God's plain language term, adultery. When a husband or wife commits adultery, each uses a more modern, less sinful-sounding term, cheating or having an affair. I have explained in a previous chapter a case history typical of millions. A young man I knew was married to a lovely young wife. They had a fine little son. They were very much in love. Then he decided to enjoy the fascination of the chase after an affair. He succeeded. Then another affair. Soon he discovered that somehow his wife had changed. She was no longer so beautiful and attractive. She seemed no longer desirable. He couldn't figure what had happened to her. Of course, nothing had happened to her. It had happened to him. As explained before, God set in motion a law. That law always works, automatically. It worked on him. He was unfaithful to the union to which a loving God had joined him. He broke not only his marriage, but God's holy law. He defiled a God-plane relationship which even the angels are not given to enjoy. He divorced and married a self-centered, scheming woman. That marriage didn't last. How many others he has entered into since, I never knew. He did try to find solace in a false and deceptive religion, devoid of God's truth and ignorant of the way to happiness. Fornication before marriage, it has been stated before, also puts a scar on the future marriage that can never be erased or healed. Many today commit fornication and then marry the partner in fornication. I do not say such a marriage cannot be happy. It may and ought to be. But I do say that scar will always remain. It has taken something away from the marriage. Even though happy, it might have been happier. Fornication never pays its participants. God ordained that necking should be used only in marriage. But what does man do? He indulges in necking promiscuously before marriage and then too often omits it in marriage. Actually, believe it or not, if God had made it beneficial and issued a command for all young people to neck promiscuously prior to marriage, nobody would. Whatever God says do, people don't. Whatever God says don't, people do. Deterrence to marital happiness. And so a frequent deterrent to happiness in marriage, to the very stability and security of the family and home, is the misplacing of necking, resorting to it in dating before marriage, neglecting it in marriage. This is probably a serious source of marital troubles. The lack of this knowledge of differences in sex stimuli and timing under a religious regime that forcibly withheld the information wreaked enormous tragedy. Wives have been cruelly hurt, virtually raped, disaster resulted. And even today, in this era of supposed newer physical enlightenment, the very mental attitude of many wives near or past middle age, reared in the sex is shameful teachings, prolongs tumescence even when husbands do observe this first rule of marital coitus. If a wife has been seared with the hot iron of this unrighteous teaching, feeling subconsciously that she is doing wrong or submitting to wrong, her mind greatly retards the process of preparation. Another very important deterrent is the widespread fear of pregnancy. This fear repels many wives, but let intelligence and love drive out fear. Why should pregnancy be feared? Is Planned Parenthood wrong? A special chapter, chapter 14, will be appended in this revised edition on this subject. The Roman Catholic Church has always responded yes. But if the Bible, the Holy Word of God, the Maker's instruction book to mankind, be your true authority, it says no such thing. Another deterrent to marital happiness has often been a false view of the real meaning of marriage. Many have been victims of the false notion that marriage bestows on husbands certain rights to satisfy a concupiscent, selfish gratification without waiting for lovemaking in preparation for the wife's enjoyable participation. And this false idea assumes also that marriage imposes certain duties on the wife to submit to being virtually raped. Marriage confers no such rights and imposes no such duties. Conversely, some scheming women have supposed marriage conferred upon them the right to a man's money, to take their half, giving nothing. Many women have married wealthy men for their money. Any such marriage is fraudulent in God's sight. Another deterrent is letting down after marriage. During the dating and romance stage, both groom and bride-to-be put a best foot forward. They are careful about manners, grooming, the courtesies. Then after marriage comes the letdown. If you want a happy marriage, be far more particular about all such things after marriage than before. Be careful about your sleeping garments. Be sure they are neat, clean, attractive to the other. Be careful about your hair, especially on rising in the morning. The very first thing I try to do on rising is to get a comb and brush before my wife sees tousled and messed up hair. Wives, I do not exactly know the solution of pricking and stabbing a husband in the face with all those hairpins with which so many females think they must tightly bind their hair overnight. Don't just giggle at this. I hope you wives may find a way to relieve suffering husbands and still have your hair looking radiantly beautiful next morning. Ever notice how people answer the telephone? A wife calls her husband at his place of business or work. He answers, "Oh, it's you. Well, I wish you wouldn't bother me now. I'm busy." But if some other woman might call on a matter of business, his voice is cheerful, courteous, warm, and friendly. And, of course, it's the same when hubby calls the wife during the day. She's warmly cheerful and polite to all but him. She feels, "Oh, he's only my husband." When I'm at my office, I do have to be shielded to a certain extent from constant telephonic interruption. But there was one voice that always got right through to me, Mrs. Armstrong's. All my secretaries and switchboard operators were instructed that I was never too busy to be interrupted by her. Little things like these are some of the reasons our marriage was so happy for nearly 50 years. If you must be cross, discourteous, or appear tired before someone, let it be anyone else, but never your husband or your wife. Don't ever utter the alibi, "Oh, but we're married now." Be lovers as long as you live. And always remember, love is an outgoing concern. Love is very patient, very kind, is never rude, never irritated, never resentful. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 and 5, Moffat. That is God's definition of love. God ordained that husbands and wives should be that kind of lovers. The all-wise and all-loving Creator designed sex for marriage and for the expression of love in marriage as well as the bringing of children into the family. He designed marriage to be a love relationship. The other three phases. This first phase of the sexual act is the most important because it is the most abused. Some books dealing with the physical details of marriage may devote many pages to the next three phases. For our purposes here, a brief few words will suffice. The textbook alluded to, which I've used in classes, lists the other three phases as 2, the union of the organs, 3, the motion of the organs, and 4, the orgasm. The following comments are very important in regard to the second. Never come to the second phase until the first is thoroughly accomplished, until the wife is fully prepared. When she is sexually aroused, the shrunken folds of the vaginal walls will loosen up. There are lubricating glands which will provide adequate lubrication for the easy and comfortable penetration of the penis. just outside the vaginal entrance, inside the labia minora, are lubricating glands called Skene's glands and Bartholin's glands. During sex arousal, these glands exude a lubricating fluid so necessary for any enjoyment in coitus by the wife. It means the difference between pain and pleasure. Even after arousal, with blood filling the generative region, the vagina softening up and lubricated, in some cases there may be some pain caused the wife by entrance of the male organ. In such case, the penetration must be gentle, slow, and careful. The husband should hold more or less still, and the wife do the pushing. Also, in the case of the first act of coitus by a newlywed virgin, if any today, absolutely no effort at a union of the organs should be made until the wife is sexually aroused and prepared. Then let the husband hold rigidly still, and the wife do what pushing or make what motions are necessary for breaking the hymen. This may be a little painful, but the wife knows how much pain she can stand, and if she does the pushing and breaking, she knows precisely when it is coming. Full instruction regarding hymen breaking is given in chapter 15. How is the husband to know when his wife is fully aroused and ready for the second phase? She must let him know. She should not be too shy with her own husband to tell him. But if she is, she may simply cease resisting at this point. The all-important clitoris. And now it becomes necessary to say a few words about a small feminine organ which is of great importance. The clitoris, previously described, is simply a miniature of the male penis. This is not generally realized because only the glands, or head, is visible. The small shaft or body of this organ is covered with the skin just above the upper end of the labia minora. The nerve endings in the clitoral glands are even more acute than in the glands of the penis, so that even though much smaller, it is the seat of female sexual arousal. Inside the labia minora is the region termed the vestibule. In the case of a wife who is not sexually stimulated to complete preparatory arousal by normal kissing and caressing and loving embrace, it may be hastened by allowing the organs to come together, but without penetration of the vaginal canal. Instead, let the position be such that the gland's penis is placed in the vestibule, but in the upper portion in contact with the clitoris. A continuous gentle movement in this position with kissing will hasten arousal, but the wife should be careful not to allow this means of stimulation to proceed to the point of orgasm. As soon as sufficient arousal is attained, she should immediately withdraw from this position and proceed at once to the second phase, the union of the organs. Now we come to the third phase, and just one point is of vital importance here. Unless this is realized and care taken, the positions of the bodies may be such that no contact is formed with the clitoris. For this very reason, millions of unhappy wives through the centuries have never realized that women are intended to enjoy the pleasure of love in coitus, the same as their husbands. In fact, probably millions of women have been married, become mothers and grandmothers, and finally died, never knowing they possessed such an organ as a clitoris. Of course, at the other end of the pendulum, many little girls accidentally discover this and start masturbating. Mothers should be diplomatically watchful for signs of this. Just about every so-called authority whose book I've seen and the medical associations universally chorus the minor discordant error that masturbation does no harm. I say to you on authority of Jesus Christ and the Word of God that it does do harm, not only physically, even though temporary, but psychologically, emotionally, mentally, and most of all morally and spiritually. Masturbation is not so prevalent among girls as boys, but nevertheless a too large percentage indulge in it either occasionally or habitually. Most boys and men practice masturbation to a greater or lesser extent. In many, it becomes an almost unbreakable habit. This would never be if parents realized their responsibility, were vigilant, ever watchful imperceptibly, and took proper means to protect their children from this curse. And don't be too embarrassed. It's your responsibility as a parent. You are not fit for parenthood if you feel too embarrassed to protect your children. Be sure to read the full instruction about masturbation in chapter 12. But back now to that all-important little organ, the clitoris. We had come to the third stage of this marital coitus. it is vitally important that the bodily position of husband and wife be such that contact is established with the clitoris. If the husband's body is placed too low in relation to the wife's, there will be no contact. The male body must, then, be a little higher in relation to hers, so that the base of the penis near the abdomen is in contact with the clitoris, the seat of female sensation. When proper contact is established, the clitoris will be almost directly between the husband's and wife's pelvic bones. I am well aware that many authorities today claim that a clitoral orgasm is immature and that orgasm should be produced by vaginal contact alone. One doctor, a professor in a very large university, goes as far as to recommend that the bodies of husband and wife ought to be across each other, forming a cross instead of face to face. If God be our authority and the Bible our approach, it refutes and voids all such nonsense immediately. It is not through ignorance, but on authority, that I say dogmatically, marital coitus should be in the general position of the love embrace, face to face, since God ordained this act for humans to be that occasional supreme expression of love. It could well be concupiscent lust in the manner certain authors recommend in this flood of sex books available today, but God made it for love. Perhaps by now the reader understands why we are unable to recommend any existing book, why this book had to be written. In most of these books, much is said about the many possible bodily positions. I do not deem it necessary to comment on that here. All married people know the two most natural and commonly used positions. Sex can become a matter of lust, perversion, or plain self-gratification and concupiscence, even in marriage. Any such experimenting with abnormal positions and unnatural or perverted ways of performing coitus should be avoided. The author mentioned here calls this third phase of sexual intercourse the motion of the organs. The organs of both husband and wife should engage in this motion. If the husband is above, he should be careful to avoid resting his whole weight on his wife by largely sustaining himself on elbows and knees. This allows her to lift her hips up and down slightly or sway them from side to side or swing in a circling motion as she may choose. This is better made possible by the wife placing her heels from outside her husband's legs in the rear knee hollows of his knees, also clasping his body with her arms. This gives her leverage to draw toward him and so gain contact with the clitoris and with whatever pressure she may desire. Nothing more will be said about this third phase of the act, except that both husband and wife, in full assurance that this entire drama of lovemaking is God-designed and God-blessed, should strive to make an art of it. Learn to move gracefully, and each try to please the other. In a God-bound marriage, rid your mind of all inhibitions. Wives should learn to let go, giving themselves an utter and loving blissful surrender to the husband with whom God has made them one. Now we come to the climactic fourth phase of marital intercourse, the orgasm. This possibly is the most intense physical sensation possible, delightful beyond description if not too frequently indulged. It need not be further described. But several things do need to be said about it. Misconceptions about pregnancy. Every husband and wife should strive for one objective here. That is to arrive at this climax simultaneously. I said strive. It will take striving and perhaps time and experience. Perhaps never will any couple be able to perfect this technique to a point where orgasm is simultaneous regularly and every time. But it is a goal worth striving for. This may require mental retarding on the part of the one arriving at this climax faster, concentrating the mind on something else temporarily, and complete abandonment of all inhibiting or interfering thoughts on the part of the other. At the instant of orgasm, the semen is thrown in repeated jets from the penis into the vagina in the region of the cervix. However, orgasm on the part of the wife brings no corresponding emission of fluid. Many mistaken ideas abound in regard to pregnancy at this point. Some have supposed that unless the woman experiences orgasm, there can be no pregnancy. That is false. Orgasm by the wife has absolutely nothing to do with conception, one way or the other. Then why do or should wives experience orgasm at all? This voluptuous explosion in women was designed for a holy God for one purpose only, for her supreme pleasure, delectation and delight in the love embrace with her husband. It has nothing to do with conception or reproduction. It is something animals know nothing of. Animals reproduce, but they do not marry or express the delights of love in marriage. Women do. Yet for centuries, millions of women were denied even the knowledge of this by the suppression of information during those dark age years of prudery and repression. Millions of women have borne and reared their children, never knowing that women are supposed to experience the joys of orgasm the same as husbands. Yet now today, under the avalanche of numerality enlightenment, millions of teenage girls learn all about it in premarital sin. Thank God Jesus Christ is soon coming to straighten out this crooked, ignorant, mixed-up, God-defying world and bring it peace and real happiness. There are other misconceptions about pregnancy. Some think there can be no conception as long as the female hymen is unbroken and no male penis has ever entered the vagina. But again, hundreds of thousands of babies have been conceived in this very manner. Young unmarried couples, necking, going as far as they think they dare, short of the limit, go far enough to let the organs be in contact, but only in the vestibule, not penetrating the vagina. Weeks later, the girls notice their skirts are becoming too tight. One mentioned this to Mrs. Armstrong. "You're pregnant," explained Mrs. Armstrong. "But I couldn't be," exclaimed the girl. "I'm still a virgin." "Well, you'd better see the doctor," replied Mrs. Armstrong. "Perhaps you'll believe him." The girl and the young man married immediately. They were in love and engaged anyway. They repented. Of course, God forgave upon real repentance, and their marriage has been happy with additional children, but that scar will always remain. It just can't be erased. Some mistakes are so permanent. A single drop of semen deposited anywhere in the outer vulva may easily lead to an unwanted pregnancy. But to return to the desirability of simultaneous orgasm, once complete sexual arousal has taken place, it is somewhat, at least temporarily, injurious to break off without proceeding to the climax of orgasm. This orgasm is a nervous release of built-up tension. Husbands and wives should restrain caressing and lovemaking in between the times of full intercourse to a point short of such complete arousal. The very fact that the male penis becomes erect in a matter of seconds does not mean that this full and sustained arousal has been reached. It is something that builds up more and more to a state of tension if physical contact is continued. Kissing and embracing for a moment or two may be enjoyed several times daily without this build-up, fully charged nervous condition. Yet in time of full coitus, if husband and wife enjoy the close bodily contact, a full love embrace for as much as 30 minutes or more before the second phase of the act is entered, there are some evidences that indicate this sustained bodily contact, up to 30 minutes, actually produces a healthful relaxation of nervous tensions and a stimulus to mental and physical well-being when climaxed by orgasm. But when this full tension of arousal has been generated, there must be the release of orgasm, or nervous tensions continue. Many a wife suffers all night long with unsatisfied desire, her generative organs tumescent, her nerves unstrung. Because of premature ejaculation and on achieving orgasm, her husband selfishly turned over and went to sleep. Whichever party reaches this summit first is duty-bound to continue until full release of tensions is gained by the mate through orgasm. Yet after this climax, tensions relax, interest is gone, and a desire to turn over and go to sleep seizes one. On the part of the husband, the penis will gradually lose its stoutness, and after a few moments, it will be impossible to keep it in coital contact. If this should happen, a considerate husband could, if necessary, set the alarm clock for later and then finish his duty to his wife. See also under Sexual Dysfunctions in Chapter 14 on Birth Control. All roses have thorns. This one of marital sex will present its problems. They require knowledge, they require the intelligence of human minds, and they require love, consideration, patience, and character to work out. But they pay the richest, most happy, and joyous dividends possible in the physical lives of humans made from the dust of the ground. And they are only a type of the incomparably greater, sexless but spiritual joys which we may inherit forever. Chapter 12, Dating and Teenage Morality. Dating procedures have undergone radical changes in the past 75 years, but has it been beneficial progress, or has dating become a lost art? What about going steady? What about necking, petting, premarital sexual experience? It's time to come truly up to date with the facts and with the truth. Let's have reasons for or against that are rational and that make sense. First, look at today's teenage world. Realize how it has changed. Not only is a moral revolution in cyclonic progress around the world, there also is a teenage revolution. It is, of course, a large part of the new morality as a whole. Are today's teens really worse? There are those who, in their self-confident, uninformed optimism, assure us that today's adolescents are no different and certainly no worse than those of past generations. But the facts prove otherwise. Human nature is the same, but we simply live in a different world today. The emergence of the phonograph, the automobile, the motion picture, radio and television, and other productions of the machine age have brought new influences and changing customs. Human nature, adapting to changing times, expresses itself very differently today. Some would hush up the naked facts, but the welfare of our youth is at stake. The adolescents, drifting with the immorality tide, are speeding past their elders in the downward plunge. There is a trend. It is an immoral trend. It is speeding up at accelerated pace. It's only natural for young people to follow the trend. They want to belong. It's time to face the facts squarely. People are like sheep. They all follow the leader to the slaughter, but they don't know they are being led to the slaughter. They are just a little stupid. Yes, quite a little. But they still want to belong. It's natural to just go with the group. From chaperones to loving up. Look how times have changed and moral standards with them. When my mother was of dating age in the middle 1880s, chaperones were in vogue. She wore long sleeves, high necks, and skirts that dragged in the dust. Young men didn't know what girls' legs looked like. In her embarrassment, my mother, I remember as a boy, called them limbs. When a young man began dating a young lady, it was called courting. There was little or no caressing, only when the young couple could give the chaperone the slip. It was then called spooning or sparking, and even on such rare occasions, the very proper young ladies quickly drew the line. A generation later, when I arrived at adolescence, the chaperones had disappeared. But in the earlier years of dating, after age 16, this caressing, today called necking, was not yet the general practice. Or if it was, I must have been highly ignorant. I distinctly remember one incident after I had passed 20. A girl I frequently dated and I were being driven to her home by a young man with his girlfriend. In those days, all cars were completely air-conditioned. They were open cars. It began to rain. We buttoned on the side curtains. To hold the curtain down on my girlfriend's side, I was obliged to stretch my arm over the seat behind her. I shall never forget the difficulty I experienced in keeping my arm far enough to the rear to avoid any contact with the back of her neck. I was terribly afraid she would think I was fresh if any part of my arm touched her. Today's bold young people will get a real laugh at this. Yes, indeed. Times have changed. Later, I knew of an experience involving a young man about 21 whom I knew very well. He and a 21-year-old chum were double dating two girl chums. The other couple had begun loving up, as the younger generation then termed it. So this friend of mine began to fear he would be considered slow or behind the times. Loving up was then beginning to be considered the thing to do after the first two or three dates. So this fellow began cautiously putting his arm around this girl's shoulder. She didn't shove it back. A date or two later, he worked up enough courage to kiss her. She made no objection. He remained very proper otherwise. The girl's father was dead, and her stepfather was a dealer in Buick automobiles. He and his wife often took the young couple out on Sunday afternoon rides. Very few families owned automobiles in those days. The young people sat in the back seat, and his arm usually was around the girl's shoulders. There was no objection from her mother or stepfather. It seemed to be accepted as normal. One night, sitting in a front porch swinging seat, the girl began to tell this young man how much money her father had left her. It was not a fortune, but a few thousand dollars. She began suggesting what they might do with it. "Wait a minute," he suddenly exclaimed. "Just what are you getting at?" "Why," she replied, "I thought we ought to begin to plan what we will do after we are married." "Married?" he exclaimed in sudden alarm. "Who said anything about getting married?" "Why," she came back equally surprised, "what have you been loving me up for if we're not going to be married?" The flabbergasted young man then explained that he had never indulged in loving up before, but had begun to feel out of date, supposing it was expected. The girl burst into tears, jumped up, and ran into the house, slamming the door behind her. Next day, the boy tried to contact her by telephone. Her mother answered the telephone. "Lucille told me all about it," said the indignant mother icily. "She never wants to see you again, and she never did." But in those loving-up days, prior to World War I, girls were kept decent. Actual sexual intercourse was unthinkable. The girl who did submit to it lost her honor. Have times changed? The question sounds ridiculous today. Full premarital coitus is the rule, except the word premarital is a little out of date. Even marriage is on the way out. The teen influence. Few people stop to realize to what extent the teenagers have taken over. They pretty well dominate the world picture. Isaiah foretold this day. Here is a portion of the prophecy. "Speaking of our people today in these very last days," God says, "and I will make boys their princes." Moffat translates it, "I will make mere lads their leaders. And babes shall rule over them. The youth will be insolent to the elder, and the base fellow to the honorable. My people, children, are their oppressors. The daughters of Zion are haughty." We continue with the Moffat, "holding their heads high as they walk, and ogling with their eyes, walking with their mincing steps." Isaiah 3, verses 4 through 16, the RSV. And this latter expression about ogling eyes, when properly translated, actually refers to painted eyes, makeup on the face, and sensuous manner of walking to arouse boys. Now look at the facts. Why do so many radio stations turn to a rock and roll or disco format today? Because the rating agencies will show that they have the highest ratings, that is, the largest listening audience. But who is listening? Nearly altogether just kids in the lower or middle teens. But the rating agencies do not show the time buyer who is listening, only how many. Big business and local little business consequently spend billions of dollars for radio time on the stations with the highest ratings. But then, they say that these youths pretty well dominate the nation's consumer spending. Who determines what is popular music today? The teens. Even the radio stations who do not go to rock and disco music in the main play what is called popular music. But is it music? Or is it a moan, a groan, a wail, a dirge, and a screech? Why did 10, 12, and up to 15-year-old little girls go virtually insane and actually invite demon possession over the British Beatles? That could never have happened 50 years before. Adolescents determine dancing trends, motion picture themes, radio formats, and even advertisements and most fields of entertainment. What many do not realize is that this teenage influence on the whole society is predominantly sexual influence. There is much more intense preoccupation with sex during these years than in later maturity. Therefore, sex became the basic formula for motion pictures, along with violence and crime, including murder.
This completes tape number 4, side number 2 of the book by Herbert W. Armstrong, The Missing Dimension in Sex. Please continue on tape number 5.